From KCPW in Salt Lake City, I'm Jennifer Napier-Pierce, and this is City Views. For the past two decades, Brian Sullivan has been scanning the skies, identifying and studying the migration patterns of raptors. From Antarctica to the Arctic and everywhere in between, Sullivan's fieldwork has expanded our knowledge of the world's birds. But there's only so much one man can do, and that's why he's using technology and asking for the observations of recreational and professional bird watchers to help him in his research. He's now in charge of one of the largest and fastest growing biodiversity databases ever, eBird, and is spreading the word about citizen science. Today on the program, getting the public involved in real-time science. Plus, East meets West, we hear the Sino-American sounds of the local band Mateo. All that and your calls coming up after the news. Good morning. I'm Jennifer Napier-Pierce, and this is City Views. Citizen scientists may not know how to analyze data or crunch the numbers, but they are making huge contributions to zoology, biology, astronomy, and more. These amateur volunteers are counting birds, observing the changes of global warming on plants, and collecting water samples. Today on the program, we're talking about the value of citizen science and just how technology is making it easier than ever. Joining me this hour is Brian Sullivan. He's the project leader for eBird at the Cornell Lab of Ornithology. He's also the photographic editor of the Birds of North America Online, as well as the editor for the American Birding Association's journal, North American Birds. He's written and consulted on various books. He is a co-author on the forthcoming book, The Princeton Guide to North American Birds. And Brian Sullivan, welcome. Thanks so much for your time.
Thanks for having me.
Brian Sullivan will be the keynote speaker at the annual fundraiser for Hawkwatch International. That's happening tonight, September 20th, from 6 to 9 at the Rice-Eccles Stadium at the University of Utah. You can find out more information on our website, kcpw.org. Later on in the program, we'll turn to indie rock infused with Chinese strings. We'll hear more about the local band Mateo. But first, citizen science. Have you participated in the annual Christmas bird count or observed frogs for the Hogle Zoo? What is the appeal of citizen science for you? You can give us a call. 801-355-TALK is our number, 801-355-8255, or send email to cityviews@kcpw.org. Brian Sullivan, as I mentioned in my introduction, you've been studying raptors, their biology, their migration patterns for a couple of decades now. What got you started on this path?
Well, I was introduced to birds at a young age by my parents and went to a place called Hawk Mountain in Pennsylvania where annually in the fall, thousands of raptors come by on migration. So when I was a little kid, I went up there and just really got turned on to hawk migration. There was something about it that was sort of stirring and loved to watch these birds. And it really inspired a lot of questions in me, sort of where are they coming from? Where are they going? You know, why are they using these ridges? And just really sort of started this lifelong interest in hawks and migration. And that really bloomed into a broader interest in birds later in life.
Why raptors specifically? I mean, describe some of the aspects of these animals that you just love.
Well, raptors are just really engaging birds to watch. You know, I think it's just something about hawks, eagles, falcons that people love, whether it's, you know, their hunting prowess, you know, their powerful talons and sort of fierce-looking demeanor maybe, or their incredible abilities in flight. You know, they're just really an impressive animal, all of them. And all of them have different sort of attributes that make them interesting. For me, I'm most interested in their identification. And there's a big group of people who are interested in hawk identification. And it's sort of this ongoing process of, you know, people go to hawk watches and they buy various books and try to learn how to identify these species as they're passing by. And it's really tricky, you know. At some point, the birds are far away, and, you know, you need to focus on things like shape and flight style and not so much plumage. A lot of other kinds of bird identification relies on plumage details, whereas with hawks, you're looking at more subtle features. So it's a little bit more challenging.
I was going to ask, I mean, how you actually identify birds. They fly individually or in flocks, but they're very fast. I mean, sometimes they're so fleeting that you can, you know, blink your eye and they're gone. How do you go about identifying these raptors who are just majestic birds, but I don't know. To me, they're like, oh, there's a bird.
Yeah, well, you know, it really boils down to a lot of time in the field and experience. And you get to know these birds. Each one of them has a distinct profile and shape, the way they fly, the way they behave in the field. All of these are cues. And we do use plumage when you can see it. So, for example, a red-tailed hawk, the adults have red tails. They're the only raptor that has a brick red tail. So if you can see that, you can be pretty sure it's a red tail. But a lot of times you can't see that because the lighting is bad or the bird's at some angle that doesn't show you that. So you have to learn how to identify it, much in the way that you would identify a family member walking down the sidewalk at a distance. You say, oh, that's my son, because I know what he looks like. You get to know what these birds look like after you look at them long enough.
I mentioned that you're the project leader for something called eBird. eBird.com, if listeners want to follow along. It's a fascinating website. Give us a bit of history of this project. I mean, what were the goals when you started out?
Right. So eBird is not necessarily related to hawks as much as it is just more of a broad general database of bird records. This project was started in 2002 by Cornell Lab of Ornithology and National Audubon. And the goal of this project was to see whether or not data collected by bird watchers could be used for science and conservation. So we had to figure out first how to collect the data, you know, so we had to build this tool that lives online that allows birders to submit their observations. And we built that tool, and we sort of had to figure out then how to engage the public, you know, how do we get birders to use this thing? And we made some tweaks to the tools that basically it found its niche because we built tools that the birding community wanted to use and that they found valuable. So it made what they already liked to do easier, and that's when it really took off and became successful. And now we gather between 3 and 5 million observations a month.
A month.
A month. So it's a lot of data, and it's really amazing to see, you know, the project's now global in scope, and the science community is really taking recognition now that data collected by bird watchers are, in fact, important and valuable and can be used in these really sophisticated modeling processes that are actually being developed around these large data sets that we're collecting.
Mm. This is a great example of what is known as citizen science. And maybe just broadly, can you give us a definition for those who aren't familiar with the term?
Well, citizen science is basically any project where the data are collected and sometimes even analyzed or processed by the general public instead of the science community.
So me, my grandma, you know, my kids, we can all be citizen scientists?
Absolutely. And there are thousands of different projects out there. They're not just revolving around birds or astronomy. There are citizen science projects that fit just about any interest. And it's really amazing now that the science community is sort of thinking outside the box and asking bigger questions that were really not possible before they had the ability to tap into the public to collect or analyze data. And the difference there is that with a project like eBird, we're asking the public to submit their observations, so the data collection process. Whereas a project like Galaxy Zoo is an astronomy project where they are processing images that are taken of outer space, and these people are basically processing visually all these galaxies. So they're processing data that have already been collected. But still, it would, you know, what it is they're using people to do what computers can't do, you know, and that's really what's very interesting about this interface between the really fast developing technology side, but there's still things that computers can't do that we as humans can do much better. So that's where the sort of interface is coming together with citizen science.
As I was preparing to speak with you today, I was amazed at the range of citizen science projects out there. I mean, we're talking aquatic invasive species, you know, asking fishermen to tell us what's on their boats, the monitoring the damage to trees by moths, counting dragonflies in their migration. I mean, you could find an interest for just about anything.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely. It's amazing to see the citizen science world really take off the last 5 or 10 years. There's a couple of resources online. If you just Google citizen science, you'll find these clearinghouses that list all of these projects. So it's pretty easy to find. There's citizenscience.org, which is a pretty good repository to find projects that you're interested in.
Your website, eBird.com, says that citizen science provides access to more and different observations and data than traditional science research. What do you mean by different?
Well, I think it's a matter of scale, really. When you think about the scale of a traditional science approach or a science study, it's generally small. There are site-based studies, or single species focus studies, things like that. And what we're doing with eBird is we're collecting data on all species of birds around the globe in real time. So for the first time, we're able to package up and provide data for just about any species around the world. And we're looking at species across the entirety of their range. So we can now visualize an entire population of birds leaving North America and moving to South America. Whereas before, you know, with a technology like banding as a process where they used to put
put a little thing on
a ring on a bird's leg with a number, you had to rely on that bird being recaptured on its wintering grounds in the tropics, and the likelihood of that is incredibly low. Even new technologies like satellite tracking, where we can actually see tracks of individual birds, they only reveal patterns on a few individuals, whereas with eBird and with citizen science in general, we're looking at broader patterns.
Hmm. Speaking with Brian Sullivan, he's the project leader for eBird.com at the Cornell Lab of Ornithology. He's the keynote speaker at tonight's annual fundraiser for Hawkwatch International. It is happening at the Rice Eccles Stadium. More information and links on our website, kcpw.org. We're talking about birds, about raptors, and about citizen science, the value of citizens getting involved in scientific observation and data collection. If you'd like to join us, 801-355-TALK is our number, 801-355-8255. So if you're getting 3 to 5 million observations a month, I mean, that's just a crush of data. How do you sift through it? Is it truly helpful? You know what I mean? Is it almost too much information?
No, there's never too much information when it comes to the kinds of data we're collecting with eBird. In fact, we're always driving for increased participation. So we want, you know, 10, 20, 50 million records a month.
Okay, so how do you use it, though? I mean, do you get to what you need?
Yeah, well, there are basically, for modeling processes, we have to now use the National Science Foundation's huge computers called Lone Star to model these data, because in order for a desktop computer to run one model on one species, it would take a few weeks of just constant processing time. So we are, you know, coming up with these processes to create models of these data, but the models perform a lot better as data volume increases. So we're still pushing more and more data. And the reality is that it is very data intensive and processing intensive to model the data, but the data are used for a variety of things, not just modeling. So you might have somebody who's writing a book on the birds of Wisconsin, and they can then easily access the slice of data for Wisconsin on a particular species, and they can, you know, pull the data down and put it into some program like Excel and just manipulate it that way. Mm. So it depends what your use is, but I would say there's never too much data.
If I were to go out and I said I was able to identify a certain type of hawk in my neighborhood, I put that into eBird. I mean, I'm a novice. How reliable is the data? Can you trust people who are not scientifically trained to go out there and give you information that is accurate?
I would say absolutely yes. First of all, bird watchers, beginners, intermediates, experts, you know, these people are out there looking at birds because they're interested in birds and they're really trying to identify these things to the best of their ability. There's a lot of resources out there that are helpful. There's really advanced field guides that help people identify birds, mobile apps, all sorts of things are developing to make it easier to identify birds. That said, there are observations that come in that defy logic. And we have a very advanced data quality process that sits behind the scenes where literally every checklist that comes into eBird, and by checklist, I mean a list of species reported at a date and location. So instead of just seeing the one hawk that you observed, it would be, I sat out there for 10 minutes and saw the following birds. That's a checklist. Each of those that come into eBird are vetted. So they go through an automated process that checks what you're reporting against what is historically known to occur here on this date and location. So it's very specific. And then if your record gets flagged because it doesn't fall within those expected levels, say you reported a common blackhawk from up here in Salt Lake City, that would be a rarity. So the record would then get flagged, which triggers this process behind the scenes where actually humans become involved. Mm. We have editors in every state, and in many cases we have editors, sometimes multiple editors in each county, who are looking at these records that are, as they come in. And they would send you an email and say, you know, this is an unusual observation for this date and location. Can you provide some details? And this discourse happens between the beginner and the expert. And that's a really sort of unsung process that's really helpful. You're connected immediately with someone who knows a lot about birds and the distribution and abundance of birds in this general area. So you're learning from an expert right away. Maybe you did see a common blackhawk and you got a photo of it and you can send that photo to him and he can corroborate the record and then it goes into the database. Maybe you didn't quite document it well enough, in which case it gets set to probable or possible, but it doesn't make it into the scientific side of the database. It stays in your records only.
But I guess with the growth of technology, that's really made citizen science possible on the scale that you are practicing right now. I mean, you couldn't do it without
the internet. The tools. It would be impossible. The internet has allowed us to reach globally with concepts like this, you know, and someone in China can submit their observations and take this project and run with it, you know, just because we have this interconnected planet now and this technology that makes it possible.
Speaking with Brian Sullivan, he's the project leader for eBird at the Cornell Lab of Ornithology. He is the keynote at tonight's annual fundraiser for Hawkwatch International. That's tonight, September 20th, from 6 to 9 p.m. at the Rice-Eccles Stadium at the University of Utah. You can find out more information as well as ticket information on our website, kcpw.org. We need to take a short break. We'll be right back. This is City Views on KCPW Salt Lake City. Welcome back. This is City Views. I'm Jennifer Napier Pierce. In March of this year, bird watchers reported more than 3 million bird observations across North America into the online database eBird. It's an online resource that's collecting critical data for science by watching bugs or counting stars or collecting bugs. The public is making valuable contributions to scientific research, and today on the program, we're talking about this idea of citizen scientists with Brian Sullivan. He's the project leader for eBird at the Cornell Lab of Ornithology. He's the keynote speaker at tonight's annual fundraiser for Hawkwatch International, and you can find out more details online, kcpw.org. But you can join our conversation as well. Give us a call if you've got questions about counting birds or becoming a citizen scientist. 801-355-TALK is our number, 801-355-8255. You mentioned that, you know, the technology is really allowing it's the portal that allows all of this sort of citizen scientists to really go to the next level. But it does take a lot of effort on the part of the researchers. Is it worth the time and effort for these scientists to take the time to sift through all this data that's coming into them to, you know, address the flagged trouble spots? Is it worth it for science?
I would say it certainly is worth it. And to give you an example, in the last 2 months, we've been cataloging data requests of the eBird data set, and we've probably had 75 organizations, institutions come to us and request data. Now, the data can be the processed data that I was talking about earlier, that we use these big processing models to generate, or it can be basic data requests like the person who's writing a book in Wisconsin. Nonetheless, there are lots of data requests coming in, and some of the organizations range from the United Nations to the EPA to the Bureau of Land Management. You know, lots of state agencies, NGOs around the world. It's really amazing to see the interest in this data set. And I think that, as I was sort of driving at earlier, it's the first time we've been able to look at these bird populations at such large scales. So that's the real interesting component here, is being able to see what these populations are doing on a daily basis, essentially. Mm. So it's pretty amazing, the volume of data. And I think that there aren't many scientists that complain about having too much data.
Are there geographic areas that you're targeting, maybe places on the planet that you don't have many observations from and you'd like more?
Yeah, southern Utah.
Southern Utah, really?
Now, well, if you think about the footprint of citizen science in general, by design, it falls almost directly on top of a map of human population. So what we're seeing is data that are not distributed evenly across the landscape as we would like to see in a perfectly designed scientific study. We see clumps of data around cities and population centers. And the challenge with our modeling process is to make predictions into those areas where we have sparse data. So if you think about the landscape of the United States, states like Nevada, Wyoming, the Dakotas, Nebraska, you know, they're not
a lot of wide open spaces.
Wide open spaces, not a lot of people, not a lot of bird watchers. Those places are really important for people that want to make a bigger impact with their observations. If you want to add a lot to our knowledge of birds and eBird, go to Nevada and do a bunch of counts out in the sagebrush. That'll really help us. That said, you know, our models are really good now. As the volume increases, we do get some counts from out in those habitats, and just having a few counts out there improves our ability to make predictions and to understand birds out there. So I would say if you want to make a better contribution to eBird or a bigger contribution, you can try to get off the beaten path a little bit and try to submit observations from places where you don't normally see a lot of people. Hmm. That said, we want all data, and we have this concept that all data have value. So if you're the kind of bird watcher who enjoys watching your backyard feeders, you can put in your observations from your feeders every day. And that time series of data throughout the year and over the years tells us a lot about the bird populations in your yard. And with thousands of yards across the landscape, we can really learn a lot. So you don't have to be a globe-trotting birder to contribute to this project. You can be anywhere from a beginner to an expert.
Hmm. I noticed as I was looking at the variety of citizen scientist projects that many are involved with changes in the planet, have to do with climate change and global warming. You are a globe-trotting bird watcher, and I'm wondering if you've seen changes in the migration patterns or behaviors of the raptors that you study.
Well, it's a difficult thing. You know, climate change is a pretty hot topic right now, and the data we're collecting in eBird and the data that Hawkwatch International collect on their migration sites, all of these data sets will go into the models that people are running on climate change. eBird was actually used in a recent study to show some effects of climate change. So, you know, I think that it's not just raptors, it's all species of birds. And we are seeing some evidence that there could be some earlier migration and things getting out of sync between birds and the insects that they eat and things like that. But I would say, you know, we need to take a long view of that and make sure that, you know, we have enough data to really make a firm statement.
So still early days when...
Yeah, I mean, eBird was only launched in 2002, although we have data that go back to the 1800s because you can put old data in. Most of the data that we're gathering actually have come from 2005 onward, so that's not that long a time series to really make too much predictions in terms of shifting, you know, population patterns and things like that. But I will say that there is some interesting patterns that we are seeing in some of these models.
How is the data that you're collecting being used? Can you give us a few examples of what you've got on eBird and how that's translated into discoveries or new research angles?
Yeah, absolutely. One of the things that we do that we're really excited about at the Lab of Ornithology are these visualizations of bird migration. And the models that we use are called STEM, which stands for Spatio-Temporal Ensemble Model. And these models basically allow us to visualize the entire population of birds migrating across the lower 48. And what we can see that was never visible before are patterns where birds that nest maybe in the eastern portion of their range migrate earlier than birds that nest on the Great Plains. Same species, but these subpopulations are doing slightly different things. And these changes, we think, are potentially related to subspecies level differences. And we might be seeing, actually visualizing, subspecies level differences in birds that were never described before. So it's kind of interesting if you think about the way birds have been described historically. It's, you know, looking at differences in their morphology and plumage and things like that in museum trays. But these citizen science techniques are allowing us to look more at the phenomena of migration, phenology, timing, things like that, that are real biological differences between these populations that may not manifest in museum specimens.
So, have you made any discoveries of new species? Or, as you said, there are some subtle changes that maybe you haven't recognized before.
Well, I wouldn't say that we've made discoveries of new species, but we're definitely seeing this phenomenon that's called cryptic species, where you have a bird that was once called the winter wren, which is this nondescript little wren that likes dense forest, stays down low in the understory, and it's really hard to see. But the birds in the east are very different from the birds in the west in that the birds in the east have a long migration. They breed up in the boreal forest and then winter in the southeastern U.S. The western birds don't move at all. They're resident. So when you visualize that map, you can see that this group in the west just stays put and this group in the east moves back and forth. So, you know, the bell goes off right away. Maybe there's more to these subspecies level differences than we thought. And that group was actually split into two species recently. One is now called the Pacific wren, and the other one's called the winter wren, still the eastern version. But those kinds of patterns, you know, we're exploring on a bunch of different species.
How important? I guess I want to get back to this idea of having your average Joe, your non-scientist, going out and collecting data on a whole range of issues. How important is the citizen science movement becoming to the scientific community? I mean, do you feel like scientists are relying more on the public to be their eyes and ears?
I think they definitely are. And I think for the first time, the science community's eyes are really wide open to the potential of engaging the public to answer some of these questions that are much broader than have ever been asked before. You know, it was not possible to think about visualizing bird populations at a global scale until we had the technology to make that happen. So now that the technology exists, scientists are thinking outside the box a little bit, and they are relying on the general public to do more and more. And I think that it goes both ways, in that if science is beginning to value the contributions of the public is beginning to value more the contributions of science.
Hmm. Do you think the lines will blur at some point? I mean, is that what the future of science looks like? It's more of a societal collaboration generally?
I would say that there will be some blurring, but I think there will always be a group of very trained, analytical-minded people who do the analysis side of things, and there will always be a group of people who are more interested in the actual engagement with nature that happens through citizen science. You know, it's, if anything, it's really a way to get out there and get your hands in the dirt, or, you know, lift your binoculars and look at some birds. And a lot of people like to do that anyway, but this citizen science process makes it possible to make your observations more meaningful.
Hmm. Final question. If you want to be involved as a citizen scientist, where do you start?
Well, I would start at one of the online portals, like citizenscience.org. And everything is broken down there by group. So if you're interested in looking at birds, all of the bird-related projects are there. The mammals are there. The first thing you need to figure out is which project you might be interested in participating in. And then from there, depending on the project, there's different avenues to get involved. With eBird, it's as simple as just signing in, creating an account, and you can just go ahead and submit your first observation. Mm. It's that simple. Other projects that have more involved protocols and things like that may require you to read a document that tells you more about how to do things. And, you know, it just depends on sort of what level of participation you're interested in.
Something for everyone out there, I'm sure. Brian Sullivan, he's the project leader for eBird.com or eBird.org. Either one will get you there. At the Cornell Lab of Ornithology, he is the keynote speaker at the annual fundraiser for Hawkwatch International. That's happening tonight, September 20th, from 6 to 9 p.m. at the Rice-Eccles Stadium at the University of Utah. You can find out more information as well as ticket information through links on our website, kcpw.org. Brian Sullivan, it's been a pleasure. Thanks so much for your time.
Thanks, Jennifer. It's been great to be here.
Coming up next, the Sino-Chinese sounds of Mateo. But first, a break. This is City Views on KCPW Salt Lake City. Welcome back. This is City Views. I'm Jennifer Napier Pierce. The All-American band members of Mateo have a thing for Chinese culture. They speak Chinese. They've spent extended periods of time in China. They love to incorporate a host of traditional Chinese stringed instruments into their music. Mateo is the featured artist on this month's KCPW Sounds from the Lounge. And today on the program, three of the four band members join us to chat about their unique blend of East meets West indie folk. And I will introduce the members of the band, but I'm not sure I can get all of the names of the instruments correctly, so you guys will have to help me out here. Bryn Chipman, she's on vocals. Arhu?
Good job. Yes.
Okay, what is the arhu?
The arhu is like a Chinese violin. It has two strings and it's played on your lap.
Okay. The violin, I know that one. And then the horse head fiddle.
Right.
What is that?
That is the Mongolian national instrument, and it's sort of like a cello, and the strings are made completely of hair, of horse hair.
So. Okay. Bryn Chipman. Also with us, Jordan Riley. He plays the ron. What is the ron?
Ron looks somewhat akin to a banjo, but has no other similarities with a banjo.
Okay.
So we do call it the Chinese banjo, but it's got a name for us, and it's ron.
Okay. The ron, the guzheng.
Yep.
And what is that?
That's a Chinese harp. It's got 24, 5. You lose count, but it's got 25 some odd strings, and played differently from a harp. It's called a zither. It lays flat on your lap almost.
Okay, the guzheng and the guitar. I know that one. Jordan Riley. Also with us, Luke Williams. He's on vocals. He plays the guzheng, the bass, and I don't know what that last one is.
Liutine.
Liutine? What is that?
It's a bit like a mandolin. It's a bit more like a mandolin than ron is like a banjo. But yeah, it's sort of, we joke that it sounds a little bit like an unplugged electric guitar.
Okay. Okay. Bryn, Jordan, Luke, three of the four musicians in the band Mateo. Eric Chipman is the fourth. Unfortunately, he's got class today. Couldn't join us. Mateo, again, the featured artist in KCPW's ongoing online music series, Sounds from the Lounge, for the month of September. They'll be performing live Monday, September 24th at 7 o'clock at the Rose Wagner Theater here in Salt Lake City. It is a free evening in celebration of the Chinese Mid-Autumn Festival, and it coincides with the release of their new album. So we're speaking with Mateo today. If you'd like to join us, 801-355-TALK is our number, 801-355-8255. Enough talking. Let's go to the music. I want to play something called Brocade River Barcarolle. Before we hear a clip of this, tell us about it. How do you describe this sound?
So this is a song that we wrote on our recent trip to China. We were there as artists in residence at Sichuan University, and we were living. Chengdu is a city with a big river flowing through it, and it's called different names at different parts of the city. But in one of the parts of the city, it's called the Brocade River, and we were around rivers a lot. Sichuan is a means for rivers. That's the province that we were in. So we wrote this. A barcarolle is like an Italian like gondola song. So we wrote this sort of like lilting river song that's about rivers and Chinese poets and river birds.
All right, let's take a listen. Brocade River Barcarolle by Mateo.
That's floating me in between the chicken streets, the cardboard caught in river weeds, the egrets watching soberly. One leap I can finally hold. He dives to grasp his misery. The egrets watching soberly. Chuya makes a riverbed and pulls the river overhead. He hears the anxious paddle beats. The egrets watching silently.
Brocade River Barcarolle, which was recorded here at the KCPW Member Lounge here on Library Square. The group is Mateo. Okay, so three of the four members of this band from Salt Lake City, one from Payson, Utah. What is the fixation with Chinese culture, Chinese music? How did you become involved in these really cool, sort of exotic instruments?
Most of them start from serving LDS missions.
Okay, this is Jordan.
This is Jordan. And I am one of those. Three of us did serve there. And before that, my dad went to Taiwan in the 70s, spent a couple of years there as well. And independently, the three of us kind of started collecting our own Chinese instruments on those travels. And then we swindled Luke into...
becoming Chinese.
The idea of a Americana folk adding Chinese instruments band.
Like, how long have you guys been together? Where did this come from? How did it gel, Bryn?
We have been together now almost 3 years.
Yeah, I think that's right.
It started, so my husband, Eric, who's not here, wrote and recorded music on his own, as did Luke. And Jordan's classically trained on the guitar, and I was classically trained on the violin. And like he said, we sort of all had an interest in Chinese music, but we knew that it's often a little bit inaccessible to Western audiences in just the form that it's presented. And so we loved the sounds of the instruments and decided that we wanted to make something not American and not Chinese, but in the middle where they meet, because cultures meet. There's no way to avoid it, and we wanted to make something great with that meeting. So,
you sing primarily in English?
Yes, we do.
Mm-hmm. Why?
Why? Because we speak English. our English is better than our Chinese, and we don't claim to be or try to be Chinese. We know we're American, and we know that we love a lot of parts of Chinese culture, but we are who we are, and we want to be true to that. We have some Chinese lyrics in our newest songs, and there may be more Chinese lyrics in the future. We're not sure, but as for right now, we sing in English and use Chinese instruments.
And basically because I think we all grew up listening to the Beatles and not whatever was popular for at that time in China.
How hard was it to pick up these foreign instruments and to play them and to become proficient at them? And they're so beautiful, but I mean, how closely related are they to the guitar or to the violin? Jordan?
They are...
Right.
It depends on the instrument.
And I think, I mean, I'm not that much of a multi-instrumentalist. Luke has played a lot of instruments, but as far as understanding, they still use the same scales, basically, the same space between notes, and so you can fiddle around with it long enough to figure it out.
The bowed instruments, on the other hand, were very difficult to translate the skills. I thought initially it would be easy, and then when I picked them up and tried, found out it was very different technique, and that's part of what we were learning this summer in China is the technique, because we couldn't find anyone really to teach us here, and we went to China to learn and learned how wrong we were doing it and learned how much behind each of these instruments should go into it.
Luke, I want to hear more about the trip. I mean, how did you get hooked up into the, was it a class or a semester? Did you say, hey, this is my favorite Chinese instrumentalist, give me a lesson? how did that work?
So the University of Utah has a sister school in Sichuan, and we got sort of hooked up with it through the Confucius Institute, which is an organization that operates out of the University of Utah that promotes like Chinese language learning and culture abroad. But we just sort of made it up. They don't like have an artist in residency program, but we sort of thought it would be a cool idea. And they had actually sent some musicians over here a few years ago. So we approached them about sort of going over like representing the university a little bit and sort of, it turned, the reality of it once we were there was like very different from what we may have thought, but it was great. We were essentially taking lessons from students at that university who were, who played in the classical folk orchestra at the university.
And how long were you there, for the summer?
We were at the university for like, we were taking lessons for 2 weeks, and we were at the university for three or four, and we were in China for about six.
Wow, sounds like a great experience. We're speaking with Luke Williams, Jordan Riley, and Bryn Chipman, three of the four musicians in the band Mateo. They're performing live on Monday, September 24th at 7 o'clock at the Rose Wagner Theater. It is a free evening in celebration of the Chinese Mid-Autumn Festival, and it coincides with the release of their new album, The Sichuan Project. Did I say that right? Sichuan Project. And they are also, of course, the featured artist on this month's KCPW Sounds from the Lounge. You can check him out on our website, kcpw.org. Want to play another song that was recorded here in the Member Lounge at Library Square, Sweet Sweeping Joy. Bryn, do you want to set it up for us?
Sure. This song was actually the birth of Mateo, and so it's a very good song to choose. This is the first song where we incorporated the zither harp and the violin and the bass and the guitar and the ron, and we got together, and this was the first time we felt like, wow, this is going to work. Let's do it. And so it just went from there. So,
Bryn Chipman, the song is Sweet Sweeping Joy. The group is Mateo.
Did you sleep through the night alive, Elizabeth? Buried in a bed, and the world it turned around, and I was found buried in my head. You got ears to hear, and I songs to sing, and a heart shall heart. To bring us safely afloat across this thick thing, the truth. I was waiting, wanting nothing more.
Sweet Sweeping Joy by the group Mateo, the birth of Mateo, as Bryn puts it. We've got band members Bryn Chipman, Jordan Riley, and Luke Williams in studio talking about their band. Again, they've got a new CD coming out shortly, The Sichuan Project. They've got a free concert at the Rose Wagner Theater this Monday night at 7 o'clock here in Salt Lake City. And, of course, you can check them out. Their videos are online at kcpw.org. I love how that song transitions. I mean, you can feel the East meets West. It's right there. It's kind of really cool how you integrate the folk influence. I mean, how do you know when to go from the traditional to the folk tradition and bring those together? Does anyone want to talk about that?
Yeah, the instruments are obviously different and more simple in my case, much more complicated in Bryn's case, but you can't play it the same that I would play a guitar or Bryn would play the violin. So just out of necessity, what you're going to improvise or make up or write on the instrument for that matter is going to come out differently than what it would on your regular six-string guitar or four-string violin.
When you were in China and you were getting tutored by these musicians on traditional Chinese instruments, I mean, did you play what you do here for them? I mean, what did they think, Luke?
Yeah, we actually, so that while we were taking lessons, it was, I mean, we're all like hacks at these instruments because we've taught them to ourselves. And so over there, I mean, it was like, starting from square one, like you're holding the pick wrong,
you're holding the bow wrong.
Yeah, it was like and so we'd sometimes get little glimpses. Like I think Eric one time played a little bluegrass lick on the liotin, which is like a mandolin. His teacher was like, "I've never heard anything like that." But then at the end of our lessons, we actually put on a concert that with the Chinese students from the Chinese Folk Orchestra, where we would trade off songs. They'd play traditional pieces and we'd play our stuff. And at that concert, I think some of them sort of got a little better what was happening. And
before this concert, we did play. We arranged a Satie piece, like the Eric Satie, you know, like just like basically 20th century classical piece, a piano piece, and we played it all across four Chinese instruments, I think.
Mm. Yeah,
and we played it for him, and afterwards we're just like, that was very innovative in the most patronizing of ways. But then after when we did what we do with this live concert, there was at the end of the first song when we just played it all out and played it loud, and it was kind of a pause of like,
and there were just all and these then eager there was a faces. Pause,
and it was like yeah, and they yeah. just they really did like it.
It was really new.
And it was really refreshing for us because we thought for sure that they'd be like, yeah, anyways, it was kind of nice, but here's the list of things you're doing wrong.
Here's the traditional way. Now play it like yes. this.
We've been doing this for thousands of years.
That kind of, you know, that moment. Do you get that kind of response, that reaction from American audiences, Bryn?
Yeah, we. I think that's one of the more motivating things in playing is we started out just busking at the farmer's market the first summer, and we'd gather these little clumps of people, and sometimes we'd be playing and people would walk by, but then there'd be times when people would gather around and play that Sweet Sweeping Joy song, and you could just feel it, and people just looked around each other and smiled, and it just, I remember we all smiled looking at each other and just felt like this is something really great that we're doing, and that's kind of what keeps us going and writing, and I think that there's, as musicians and as what we do, there's definitely times where you just feel, it just feels great, and I think the audience can feel it and we can feel it.
Bryn Chipman, she's on vocals, arhu, violin, and horsehead fiddle. Jordan Riley plays the ron, the guzheng, and the guitar. Luke Williams on vocals, guzheng, bass, and I can't do that last one. Liuqing.
Okay.
Three of the four musicians in the band, Mateo. Guys, thanks very much for your time. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thanks so much.
Mateo is the featured artist in KCPW's ongoing online music series, Sounds from the Lounge, for this month of September, and they're also playing live Monday, September 24th at 7 o'clock at the Rose Wagner Theater here in Salt Lake City. It's a free event. It celebrates the Chinese Mid-Autumn Festival and coincides with the release of their new album, The Sichuan Project. You can find out links and more on our website, kcpw.org. City Views is a production of KCPW in Salt Lake City. Our technical director is Jesse Ellis. Ryan Cron composed our theme music. Coming up tomorrow, it's Politics Up Close with Jeff Robinson. Hope you'll join us for that tomorrow. For City Views, I'm Jennifer Napier Pierce.